Lake Michigan College is the number one community college in Michigan and ranked 13th in the nation. LMC is your community college where they connect you to your future. To learn more, check out lakemichigancollege.edu.
Hello, my name is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Peter Osnos. Peter has been with us on prior occasions before the 2024 election. And Peter is a historian, a journalist, and an activist to the extent that he has deep-held personal observations and views about life and politics and American life, and is going to share with us today some of those recollections, some of those observations. John Smetanka, Peter Osnos, With Respect. Peter, how are you today?
We're good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
So, Peter, when we last talked last year, prior to the election, there were some stunning, stunning events that occurred, which people will be writing about for 10 years or more. The election of 2024. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and all the characters around them. What happened? What did you see last year that made for the bizarre set of circumstances and consequences that happened?
You know, I obviously thought a great deal about this, because it's central to our sense of where the United States is at the moment. And I draw analogies to the past a bit. Go back over the presidencies, back to John Kennedy. Kennedy presidency ended when he was murdered. The Nixon presidency ended when he was driven from office because of Watergate. Jimmy Carter, his presidency ended because he was defeated. Ronald Reagan served for two terms successfully, as far as we know. But after he left office, it was reported that there were people in his own administration who wondered whether he had kind of lost it in the last couple of years and whether they should invoke the 25th Amendment and actually say that he wasn't really up to the job. Clinton was impeached. George W. H.W. was defeated after one term. Clinton was impeached. We then had the 2000 election in which, you know, few hundred votes in one district would have changed the results. George W. served through two terms and left the United States with two unfinished wars. So where we are now is really, in a sense, wouldn't call it a culmination because it's certainly not that, is really part of our modern history. Every presidency is challenged in profound ways by events. And what's remarkable about this presidency so far is that Donald Trump was reelected despite being impeached twice, indicted on 81 felony counts, despite the entire focus on his relationship with Vladimir Putin, a man who would and conceivably could blow us all up. So the great mystery is how this has happened. How was it that this man, Donald Trump, has defied the odds in every way possible and is the most powerful president, certainly in my lifetime? Well, I am old enough to have known that there was a president called Roosevelt, but I was a Every presidency since then, in one way or another, has been truly tested, and in many cases, I forgot Gerald Ford, who, by the way, was an unelected president. So, and then defeated. So the point is that we now have to recognize that enough time has passed, there have been enough presidencies to know that we're a country that, for whatever reasons, needs to somehow take down our leadership. And what we don't know now is whether that will be the case for Trump. If that bullet a year ago exactly had been another inch or half an inch, he'd be dead. But he was grazed. He believes God spared him. He believed God spared him, and he believes that the reason why he was able to get past the impeachments and the indictments is because he has some capacity that the rest of us don't have to outsmart the system. It's an extraordinary story. And I don't believe you or I will be able to explain it in our lifetimes.
Recently, I saw a piece by a publisher of an online news service here in Michigan, which took what you just said and extended it back to the beginning of the 1900s and took it in quarter centuries. And each of those quarter centuries from 1900 on through had major, major events, wars, depressions, threats of war, continuing economic frustrations that we somehow got through. And also in the course of those quarter centuries, fights within our country. He kept us out of war, talking about Woodrow Wilson. A chicken in every pot. We have nothing to fear but fear itself from FDR. We have all these things. There's a combination of the event and how each presidency and the people survived what could have been knockout blows. Are we going to survive?
Well, I'd have to say yes, because I can't really imagine the other answer. But I would say this. The most of the big changes, the dramatic changes in our history come suddenly. My examples are Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
Until Pearl Harbor, we weren't going into the war. We had come up with the Lend-Lease. America First was a hugely important part of the electorate. But then we went into World War II because of Pearl Harbor. I don't believe that we would have been the country we are today if there hadn't been an assassination of John Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. I think the world we were, the country we were the day before and the country we were the day after were quite different. I think 9/11 changed once again America's psychology overnight. Remember, the Cold War was over. And suddenly we had a whole new enemy, the War on Terror. And probably this era will not end gradually, but in something dramatic, which is, of course, unpredictable. And I don't know what that is. I think that we've had things like the 2008 financial crisis, which was a huge crisis in the economy, profound. We had COVID, in which millions of people died, neither one of which anybody could have told you about more or less on the day before they happened. So my sense is that where we are now, we are barrel-assing, if that's the right term, towards something unpredictable but dramatic. And that's just my instinct, because that's how things have changed in the past. We're the kind of people who, since so many of us live our lives in our lives, if you're not the one whose son was sent to Vietnam and killed, or you're not somebody who is mugged on the street, if you're not somebody who's at the other end of what we call, you know, anti-Semitism or bigotry or all those other things, essentially you get on with your life. You got families, you got kids, you got jobs, you have issues, you have your health, you have your ability to pay the rent. That's the biggest part of your life. So the question is whether what we're going through now can end just conventionally with an election in which we get a different president, or will this end in some dramatic fashion? And my instinct is that it will have a climax rather than a gradual demise or change. But of course, by its nature, that's unpredictable. I mean, I didn't get up on the morning of September 11th, 2001, knowing what by the end of the day, what would happen, and that we would be living in a completely different world, a war on terror, which became a dominant fact of the next decade or two. Donald Trump has been around for 10 years now. Exactly 10 years ago when he came down and announced that he wanted to be president. And his impact on our lives has been enormous and increasingly so. But there's no doubt, when it came to a vote, 50% plus one of the country voted for him. So he has a hold. I don't know that I understand it particularly, although I have my ideas and I mentioned some. But he has a remarkable hold on the American public, something which only history is really going to be able to explain.
I agree with that. I think that it will take 20 years to figure out what happened today and tomorrow.
Yeah, he has every branch of the three branches has been run over one way or another by Trump. Every major part of our institutional life has been run over. Universities, law firms, media. He's rolled them all. And he's rolled them all by the extraordinary strength of his will. Because that's what it is. There's no strategic plan, really. It's just, I'm Donald Trump, and I can do whatever I want. And whatever happens, I will get away with it. I need to tell your listeners, John, that from the years 1986 until 1991, I was in close touch with Donald Trump as his editor and publisher of two books, the books that made him famous. So when I hold forth on this subject, I actually like to believe that I was someone who knew the man.
And I'm going to put a hold right this, because we have to take a break, and I want to come back to finish that thought. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. We're talking to Peter Osnos, a journalist, historian, commentator on how the world, and especially the United States, is playing out its life, of which we are a part. And we're going to be talking about his relationship, his understanding of Donald Trump in a minute. But right now we're going to take a break. This is John Smetanka, as I say, on With Respect, and we will be right back. Now back on With Respect with our guest, Peter Osnos, a journalist, historian, and observer of American and international life. This is John Smetanka. So, Peter, you were talking about the time that you worked with Donald Trump, and it gave you some perspective on the man and how he thinks and works. Go ahead.
Well, I need to frame it succinctly. I was an editor. I'd come to Random House as a senior editor. And the owner of Random House was much taken with Trump because he seemed to be a celebrity in the making. And it was his idea to see if Trump would write a book. His name was Mr. Newhouse, and he said, I want you to come with me. Very quickly, Trump was flattered. Newhouse is a very powerful man. Trump agreed, and the book was done. It was called The Art of the Deal. It was published in late 1987, and by middle of 88, it sold a million copies. An astonishing number of books, and had made Trump a celebrity, a national celebrity. Before that, he'd been a New York celebrity, built buildings, you know, he was a colorful character. A year later, let's say 1989, My son, a journalist of some note himself, wanted to see professional wrestling in Atlantic City, SmackDown number 9 or whatever it was called, which Trump was the promoter. And we got tickets because I knew Trump. His office sent me fancy tickets, which I didn't have to pay for. And we went to Atlantic City to see SmackDown number 9. That's the professional wrestling, as you know, is kind of not really a sport. It involved Hulk Hogan and that kind of thing. This is 1989. A year or so after the publication of Art of the Deal, 5 years before he started to appear on The Apprentice. And when Donald Trump came into the Atlantic City Arena, 20,000 people who had paid good money to see professional wrestling cheered him more than they have cheered any of the wrestlers. He was a hero to them. And I say to this day, professional wrestling fans in 1988 and 89 admired, in some cases, and revered as a strong leader of them, Donald Trump. And what we have seen since is the evolution of that to the point where it is now. And that's why it's historically so profound. You know, he was saying then that the world's ripping us off. He would go on places like Larry King and hold, the world is ripping us off. He was talking about tariffs in 1990, 1991. He was saying it's the Germans and the Japanese who are going to take us over. So the Trump that I knew then was the same person who's there now, but it's metastasized. It's morphed into this extraordinary power and force in American life. But it's a process that's been underway. And part of my feeling about the man is that he is so completely instinctive as opposed to tactical, that he makes his decisions on a basis of what his gut tells him, nothing more. And whether it's good in his, in whether he believes it's good for him or not. You know, I'll tell you, you know, that this is a radio, so no one could see me. But I've seen pictures of myself 1990, 1991. There's one in particular where Donald Trump and I are walking through a lobby of the Mirage Hotel in Las Vegas when he was there to make a speech about the second book we did. And I'm looking at the two of us. Obviously, I was a bit older and a little bit shorter. But when I look at it now, I realize I looked like the kind of person that Donald Trump wanted as his publisher. Well-dressed, well-groomed. Donald Trump, if I was short, fat, and bald, would not have been as respectful to me as he was in the years we worked together. Mm. His cabinet is the best-looking cabinet probably we've ever had in strict terms of appearance. People like Pete Hegseth, Kristi Noem. These are good-looking and glamorous people. But are they qualified? My personal view is no. But he thought they were qualified well enough, and the Senate confirmed them all. So, as I said, My feeling about Donald Trump is that he's instinctive, willful, a man who has none of the traditional empathy or sympathy that makes life, because he's never needed it. Because every time something happens, he defies the odds. Six bankruptcies. He didn't get drafted. Five deferments. And yet, he believes he can tell the United States military what to do and have them bend to his will. Congress, Supreme Court, everybody bends to his will. Whether you like it or not is not the issue. It's a fact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we need to recognize his power and his impact and his strength as something truly, truly remarkable in American life, and something which we have not seen in this way ever.
It's interesting. You are describing what the Greeks might have used the word charisma for. I would have also used it for other people, other presidents. I would use it for FDR. I would use it for Jack Kennedy. And I might do it for Ronald Reagan. The concept, the word. And at one point I thought, you know, maybe it's some force of personality that flows out when you're near them physically. Some kind of power of attraction. And then I thought, well, no. The same effect is created over television or even radio with FDR. So I'm trying to figure out, I was for years trying to figure out what it was. But whatever it is, there is a certain power that emanates, whether through the voice, through the vision, through the words of certain
presence,
individuals.
I would say it's presence. I'll go back to FDR and Kennedy for a moment, and Reagan. Everybody, it's hard to remember now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, this extraordinarily formidable president, couldn't walk.
Mm-hmm.
No one really at the time, because mostly people saw him sitting or saw, and he and his people made it very clear that he was not going to be seen as disabled.
Mm-hmm.
So people didn't really know at the time that this was not a man who, if a crisis happened, could run out of the room.
Mm-hmm.
John Kennedy, while he was president, really faced very strong opposition on most of the things he did. And meanwhile, had a private life that in the 21st century probably would have disqualified him from the presidency. Ronald Reagan, of all of them, probably had the personality that really did enable him to be popular despite what he was doing. He was charming. Mm-hmm. He was, in his own way, an agreeable man. He said things in a way that didn't seem particularly intimidating. I think you know, again, my personal experience enables me to have some opinions. I was the editor of Nancy Reagan's memoirs called My Turn, a book she wrote as they were leaving the White House. And the key sentence in that book about Ronald Reagan was that Ronald Reagan likes people but doesn't need them, except for me, and sometimes I even wondered about that. Ronald Reagan was so much in himself and therefore fundamentally a man who was able to charm without engaging. It's often said, if you look back at some of his letters that he wrote to people, he wrote wonderful letters. He was warm and friendly, but he was inaccessible, ultimately, emotionally. That was a strength. And I think, again, that remarkable thing about Trump is that he has this gift of standing in front of people who fundamentally are not getting what he thinks they should have, and they still believe they will with him. It's a, you know, your charisma is absolutely the word. Messianic charisma. I don't know what it is. And I think in the same way that history has to judge over time, going all the way back through history, you know, to the Greeks and so on, the Romans. What is it that makes an individual so powerfully connected to people that even though he's not ultimately in their interest in so many ways, they believe that he is? We'll have to see as time goes on whether all the things he's been able to do in the first 6 months, all the programs that have been canceled, all the people who've been fired, all the welfare, Medicaid, all that other business that has been, in a sense, transformed, whether it will have any effect. One technical point. Most of the big changes, Medicaid, SAMHSA, and so forth, don't go into effect until after the midterms. That's not an accident. So we'll see. And, you know, on a very practical level, Democrats so far are in disarray. They're demoralized. Anybody who looks at them says, well, who's the leader? Who's the one I want to believe in? And that's a problem. If one party is Donald Trump and the other party is just a bunch of people, most of whose names you don't even know, or most people don't know, you know, the circular fire squad, where they, you know, I think that's a problem. And I think it is legitimately a reason for concern about the country. But as you said, and I accept it, probably we'll get through it. We don't know what will be there when it's over. I don't think it will end by natural causes. I just don't see that happening. We'll see.
We'll take a break right now. We're talking to Peter Osnos, publisher, editor of books, journalist, historian, and commentator on public life. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back on With Respect. Thank you. We're now back in With Respect with Peter Osnos, a publisher, books of Ronald Reagan and others. Also, commentator, historian, an observer of public life in America and around the world. This is John Matank on With Respect. So, Peter, where do you get your impressions of people and events? What wellspring do you have? What part of your life has brought you to the perspective that you have?
Well, John, to start with, I've been doing what I'm doing now for 60 years. 60. My first jobs were in the mid-60s, journalism. And I worked all over the world. I was a correspondent in Vietnam. I was a correspondent in the Soviet Union. I was the national and foreign editor of the Washington Post. And now I've been a book publisher for 40 years. I was the publisher, editor, and or publisher of books by four people who are presidents. I did a bunch of books, seven, with Jimmy Carter after he left the White House. I did two books with Bill Clinton, one while he was running and the second when he was running for re-election. I did two books with Donald Trump, as we've discussed. And I did Barack Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, the book that made him famous. I was the publisher of it. I'm resting on my experience. And because my personal approach to all of it is observational, I'm able, it just happens to be who I am, to deal with some of the most extraordinarily important and powerful personalities in the world and get away with it. And I mean, I named the presidents, I could name many others. People who literally, if you look at the list, it just sometimes when I look at it, because I'm an old man now, I can't believe that I was with all those people and every one of them without exception who I worked with, I was able to deal with. Didn't mean I liked them all.
Mm.
But my personal, whatever it is, skill, is being able to deal with the most powerful personalities in the world and some of the biggest egos on a level, because I was never working for them, I was always working with them. I was their editor or their publisher. I was doing something that they appreciated that I was doing for them. And in time, I was pretty good at it. So my perspective is more than opinion. It's based on my experiences and my ability to formulate words around my experiences still to this day, which is why I find that when people say, what do I do now? I'm no longer running my old publishing, my publishing company, which was sold. I say, well, I read, I write, and I pontificate. And that's my career at the moment.
Why people? There's so many people in our world who have specialties. They're carpenters, they're electricians, baseball players, priests, artists. They all have some kind of skill or focus or interest. Yours is people. What's so interesting about people to you? What is it?
Well, I think that I was, we're endowed by our creator. And I was endowed by the creator with curiosity. I'm a better listener than people think. Because my presence sometimes says, well, he's not paying attention. No, I miss very little. I have a good memory. And this is an important one, John. No matter what I've done, I've never really done it for the money.
Mm.
If I wanted to be rich, 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 I probably would have done it another way, but I'm not rich, 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 but I've got plenty. And for some reason, my motivation has always been content and much less about reward.
My father passed on to us what his father told him. And in our family, it's a DNA fault. The males become lawyers, and the teachers, I'm sorry, the females often become teachers. And so I ended up cursed with the genes which both me brought into teaching and into the practice of law. One of the things that Grandpa passed on to Dad, who passed on to me, was that A, lawyers die at their desks, and B, you ain't ever become rich if you're a good lawyer. It's not going to happen. You can become rich, but you're not necessarily, because of that, a good lawyer. And so we've tried to analyze it in our family, and I think we're interested in people. I just am interested in people. I find them fascinating. And I think that I detect from talking to you that if I had asked to scratch that particular itch, you would say there's something around the same thing.
Sure. If you are from your late adolescence and for the next 20 years plus, you're a reporter. You travel the world. You cover war. You cover tyranny. You cover politics. You cover it. You're always slightly at a remove. The skill you have is observation. I was never the president of the United States. I was never the person fighting the war. I was watching the war being fought. And my gift, such as it was to be able to have strong perception of what I was seeing. And I'd like to think common sense. You know, my personal view on the left or the right was more towards what I was seeing more than what my opinion would have wanted me to see. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true with Donald Trump. You know, if you ask me whether I approve of Donald Trump, the answer is no. But I know what he's doing. I can see the impact that he has. I recognize what an extraordinary character he is and how important he is in American public life. That's different from whether I approve of him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what reporters do.
Mm-hmm.
They observe. And obviously, in the words they use to describe things, they're passing judgment. But my effort as a writer has always been to pass judgment based on the facts and not just on my opinions.
What are the problems that brought about my doing this show is I detected years and years ago a penchant for people in journalism and on radio talk shows to blur, if not completely destroy, the difference between observation and statement of opinion. And so it became, and one of the things I cannot tolerate is the TV screeching at one another. That friends of mine who have, if not made a profession, they certainly have been brought into the world of talk journalism. When they first went in, I would hear from my friends, oh, you know what they did? They told me, I got to get in there and shout. I got to get in there and fight, because it's the fighting, it's the shouting, which gives the audience the appreciation of the belief of sincerity. And in fact, I would listen to what they were saying, and it was any more sincere than the man on the moon.
You know what? The sort of most basic reaction is the way people slow down when they see an automobile accident. It's fascinating to see things that are emotionally engaging, even if it's an automobile accident. And for some reason, we come as a culture to want to be engaged emotionally. And people arguing is more engaging than people not arguing. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why there is in so much in cultural life, and which is geared towards getting your attention. Violence, sex, war. I don't know, you know, what am I say, look, we could straighten all of this out. We could just really could. We could overnight straighten everything. Just get rid of humans. Because it's humans that cause the problem. It's humans who are responsible for climate change. It's humans who are responsible for violence. It's humans who are responsible for tyranny. Human nature ultimately is what shapes events. And human nature is immensely complicated. It involves emotions that are positive and clearly emotions in many ways that are not. And that's just the way it is and will always be. When this era is over, we will not be once again living in some placid future.
Mm-hmm.
It just won't happen. Some other way in which we will be tested is inevitable.
We're going to take a final break. We're talking to Peter Osnos, publisher, historian, observer of human nature. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Peter Osnos, editor, publisher of presidential books, reporter going back to Vietnam, and an observer of human nature. I won't say a cynic, because it's just a realistic view on human nature he's just expressed. This is the way human nature is, whether we like it or not. The world will never be perfect in the sense that it'll all settle down and we'll all love one another and every food and fuel and money, and we'll all be equally distributed. Ain't going to happen. I think he would agree.
I think, John, that we all know that our lives in one way or another are going to be tested. Nobody gets to live an entire life without being tested in one way or another. The tests come in every form: health, security, finance, emotion. Tests are essentially the fabric of lives. And I'm old enough, you're old enough, to know that how you handle those tests has a great deal to do with the outcome. Some of which you can master simply by your will, some of which you can master by your ability, some of which you just can master by luck or not luck. And that is the essence of it, really. And what, in the much more sort of specific sense of what we're dealing with in American life now, is a phenomenon at its center, an individual with force and power and drive that shapes our country, this vast, extraordinarily complicated country, is being shaped by this one man. And that's not something we've had in our lives. We certainly have it now. And that's why this is such an extraordinary period.
We are the individual's life, person to person to person. We all have, as you say, tests, whether it's your health, your finances, your emotional life, your family, community life. And that's mirrored in the life of your community and the life of your nation and the life of the world. Because, we, as you say, it's all human. It's human beings. And how we get through the various tests that we have to go through is the miracle. The fact that we have survived this long without destroying ourselves completely.
Right. And, you know, there have been one thing about modern life, certainly since 1945, is we have the capacity to destroy civilization. We have it. Russians have it. Chinese have it. It's never been used. Not since World War II. So far, in most respects, we've stopped short of the ultimate use of violence to solve problems. And we have to hope that will continue to be the case. Awful lot of people feel that we're testing the world because we're letting the environment go in the direction it is. I don't know that I'll see the outcome of it. Mm-hmm. But I definitely know that it's a lot hotter than it used to be. And some of these floods and the, you know, just last night when we got this warning of extreme 60-mile-an-hour winds and we're told to go, you know, take cover in the basement of our house and so on. That's striking. We're living in times in which danger is present. And I think we need to recognize that. We just also need to believe that it will somehow, one way or another, work out.
Mm-hmm. We have We have so far done so. And it's, I hope, my hope and the people of, that I respect, that we can continue to evolve our ability to control things to ensure that we do survive, that we improve our institutions to meet the challenges, that the people who we put in power over us have the discipline, the skills, especially those two, as well as the integrity, to keep us going on a route of survival and maybe the chance for progress.
I think progress is, if you look back at the course of history, the trend line is positive.
Mm-hmm.
But not without a whole lot of downside and disruption. The trend line is positive. We live longer, we live better than anybody ever has in history. And that's ultimately the bottom line.
I don't remember the name of who it was, a surgeon, who many years ago, hundreds of years ago, suggested that in birth, women, doctors who dealt with women in birth should wash their hands between deliveries, should cleanse themselves. And that person initially was laughed at by the majority of the professionals of his day. So this is ridiculous. And now we wouldn't even think of the possibility of not washing one's hands during from one surgery to the next. And I think that there is a certain amount of the challenging professional, the challenger to the accepted mores, customs, practices, has to go through sometimes humiliation, sometimes destruction. But they turn out to be right in the end.
Yep. I think that's very optimistic, realistic, and optimistic.
Yeah. Well, there is one that, the number that is getting bandied about these days is we are $32 trillion in underfunded in our government.
Mm-hmm. Debt. In debt.
In debt. How do we get around that? It ain't going to get around. We aren't going to get around it by simply saying, ooh, wouldn't it be better if? It's going to, something has to happen. And maybe that's the next challenge.
Well, I think, as I said, this is unsustainable, the level of debt and what it costs us to maintain the debt.
Mm-hmm.
And something will change that. World War II changed it. 2008 changed it. Something will change it. Where we are right at the moment is we're just plowing ahead and getting more debt.
Mm-hmm.
Pretending we're cutting, but we're not really cutting, we're adding.
Mm-hmm.
Spending literally vast. When I was a kid, we used to talk about being millions. We talk about billions. The other day I saw this one American company that's NVIDIA worth $4 trillion. We've gone from millions to billions to trillions. So where's it going? I don't know, and I suspect that it'll take our descendants to figure it out, but they will. I just wish that they had all the wisdom we've accrued over time.
Mm-hmm. Or that they appreciated our wisdom.
Let's hope so.
Peter Osnos, it's been a great talking to you again, and I hope to look forward to your written wisdom in the future.
Thank you very much, John. It's fun. And I like talking about myself.
And you're an interesting person to talk both to and about.
Thank you.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every week on Sunday and Thursday. Until next time, remember our motto. If you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.
Thanks, John.